CAH versus KGG. Council could please step forward. May we please have appearances?
Morning, Your Honor. Francis Devaney from the law firm of Marks O'Neill, D-E-V-E-N-E-Y, on behalf of defendant petitioner A.M.
George Harden, Harden, Cunla, McKeon, and Paletto, for the defendant petitioner Gem Ambulance.
Good morning. Raymond Gonzalez, G-O-N-Z-A-L-E-Z, on behalf of the respondent plaintiff in the matter.
Good morning, counsel. Ms. Devaney.
Thank you. Chief Justice and Associate Justices of the Supreme Court, may it please the Court, may I initially reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. The creation of new duties must be done in such a way that it generates intelligent and sensible rules to govern future conduct. The fundamental question underlying this case is what duty, if any, may be imposed on a third party, here a coworker, to report child sexual abuse and to warn a victim of abuse, even though he does not know the identity of the would-be victim? And relatedly, what is the standard for such a duty? The appellate division has introduced a vague and undefined common law basis for potential liability, one that is ambiguous at best and certainly questionable in reach and scope. The decision is silent on when the duty to report is triggered, who may be implicated, to whom must reporting be made, and what must be done to fulfill the undetermined reporting obligation. While proclaiming on the one hand that there is a public policy in favor of reporting and action is one thing, the appellate division also warned and cautioned that the imposition of tort liability on someone is in fact a further leap. The leap from a public policy declaration to liability is one that cannot be made in the absence of some statutory framework by the legislature or judicially imposed guidance from the court. The appellate division declined to recognize Title IX as a basis for liability in this case. It did so because there was no custodial relationship between GAH and KGG. Rather, the appellate court relied on J.S. to cast a wide net to trap unsuspecting parties. Although J.S. spoke only to the special relationship of the husband and wife relationship, the appellate division declined to end the inquiry there and asks that the court make J.S. the starting point to the beginning of a slippery slope. The importance of this court's determination cannot be understated. The implications of a new judicially imposed duty here, done in hindsight, are far-reaching and affect each and every member of society. And although not extensively discussed at the appellate or trial court level, the irony of this case is that there was no blanket failure to report. AM, in fact, reported what he knew when he had a reasonable belief that what he knew may have been potentially relevant. So what we're doing here is going back and doing a retrospective analysis of whether his reporting, made when it was reasonable in light of all the circumstances. The irony also is magnified by the fact that had he not come forward at all, he wouldn't be a defendant here today. How can he answer in damages to someone to whom he has no relationship whatsoever, has never met, had no duty at the time to protect, and in fact does not even know her name? Even more ironic is the fact that if AM's reporting fell under the Title IX, he would be availed of some protection under Section 8.13. However, in this case, if there is a duty crafted, he has no immunity whatsoever. The reporting is done at his own peril. When the creation of a duty is sought, there is a complex analysis in determining whether or not it's appropriate to impose such a duty. This assessment requires the weighing and balancing of several factors. Number one, the nature of the underlying risk of harm. That test is couched in terms of foreseeability and the severity of the harm. Two, the opportunity and ability to exercise care to prevent the harm. Three, the comparative interests of and the relationships between or among the parties. And four, the societal interest in the proposed solution, which must be based on public policy and fairness. The foreseeability test is based on the defendant's actual knowledge of harm, constructive knowledge, or some special reason to know. Here, there is a glaring absence of all of that. The question is based upon what AM knew, whether or not the duty to report would be triggered. Let's talk a little bit about what he actually did know. He knew that he worked with KGG on nine occasions, nine shifts, as an EMT driver. KGG would show him explicit images on a cell phone. He would glance at it, and there'd be no further discussion. KGG said, "This is my girlfriend. She's 22. Sometimes she said, he said maybe 24. Doesn't matter. Never identified her as a minor." Further, although the record was developed somewhat on this point, and I'll give all inferences in favor of the plaintiff, on one occasion, AM was with KG on a shift, and KG said, "I have to go and give my daughter lunch money." On other occasions, KG would leave the vehicle and walk someone to a bus stop that could not be seen from the ambulance. That is all. That is the entire relationship between KGG, AM, and GAH. Are we to assume, believing all of this to be true, that this is enough, that AM had a duty to report? Who would he report it to? Imagine him walking to a police station and saying, "Oh, my coworker showed me some explicit images of his girlfriend. I don't know her name. She's 22. I saw this guy walk some young girl to the bus stop." That's it. That's the entirety of the belief and the understanding that AM had. Later, AM did in fact read in the article that KGG was arrested for sexual molestation of a young girl. That is when he went to the authorities, and that is when he reported what he knew, thinking maybe this has some relevance to what I know or what I was shown. But until that point, he had no idea.
I take it your position is there could not be a worse set of facts on which to propose a duty, given that the evidence, even in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, does not indicate that AM knew anything about a relationship between GAH and KGG.
That's correct. Other than that, he was being shown images of them. He didn't know who she was. He didn't know how old she was. Of course, KGG said this is my
girlfriend. The images didn't have a face, if I recall, right? The images on the phone mostly didn't show facial features.
Your Honor, we did not, turnover of the images was not required by the trial court. However, how would that inquiry solve any question? Can you tell the age of a person simply by looking at their face, or even their genitals, or their body? We're talking about a 15-year-old girl who's months away from the age of consent. Even if those images were turned over, what would that show?
In a case like this, why wouldn't the images be turned over with a protective order?
Well, there was I think that's a two-pronged answer. The first answer is that it's not relevant. It doesn't go to the heart of the issues as to whether or not AM had a duty to report and should have reported what he knew. There's no evidence to show that whatever images are on that cell phone are the images that were shown to AM. How do you prove that? Only AM and KGG were there.
And this was a flip phone with very small screens.
Correct, Your Honor.
Indicates.
My understanding is about 2x2.
Even if it had slight probative value, this goes to the Chief Justice's question, and since the victim was the one who is requesting the release of the so-called photographs of her, like why shouldn't they have been released in discovery? Like, why not? If you would think that the one reason not to would be to protect the privacy interests of the victim, and here the victim is saying, please release these photographs.
How would the release help the inquiry of any question that would be presented by the court?
So
there is a duty...
That's an easy argument for your side, of course, to make.
Yes.
Your colleague would love the benefit of the pictures in order to be able to assess whether there's an argument to be made.
And the assessment would be what? How old is the person depicted in the photographs? What if there are images of people that are not her? How can we tell? Everyone agreed, and the victim plaintiff herself agreed, I sent pictures of my hands, my genitals, my body.
It seems
some of them had my face.
At the end of the day, it seems you probably would have been no worse off with the release, because your client was saying, at most, he just like turned to the flip phone and turned away, and that's the only evidence.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor, and I think the judge said to himself, okay, even if I turn those over, what would happen? Nothing. It would not affect the parties at issue. It would not create more weight to one side or another on a relevant fact.
Yeah, but just
your client didn't know the young lady, right, at all, so even if faces were shown, he wouldn't have known who it was.
Correct, Your
Is that
Honor.
Correct? So there was
no ability
no
to
would
identify
so that's
victim.
Her or this next, because he had no idea who she was, had never seen her. And so the facial part of the photographs wouldn't have developed any new evidence or any.
Correct, Your Honor. And the other issue is that there was there's statutory protections to a victim to preclude dissemination of child pornography.
But she's asking for it.
What's that?
She's the litigant, and she's asking for them.
Yes,
she
is.
That's a difficult
However,
argument to advance.
It would be shown to a number of people, and the court, I think, in its wisdom, said it doesn't matter.
Isn't your strongest argument that this is a question of law? It's that there's a duty here. There is no basis, even if, for whatever reason, her face was visible in one or more photographs, since he didn't even know the person, that this could possibly give rise to a duty under these circumstances.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I think that's the inquiry that the court did make in his own mind when he decided, I'm not going to order the turnover of those photographs.
What would you concede that AM's statement should have been turned over in discovery?
The trial judge did review AM's statement in camera and compared it to that of the police report or the investigative report, and he said there's nothing different here.
So why wouldn't the plaintiff be able to make that decision? I don't understand why AM's prior statement to the police was not turned over to the plaintiff.
Well, it was part of an investigation, and that's a determination that the trial court made. I don't think that it would have changed either way. The question, again, is one of duty. However...
So I understand that in your response to Justice Patterson's questions. But do you think that the trial court should have released AM's statement as part of discovery? I'm not saying it's going to alter your outcome. That is a matter of law. That just isn't enough. but shouldn't that statement have been released?
That's a discretionary call with the trial judge in terms of whether or not that has any probative weight. If it's the same information that's contained in a report already. The parties have access to that information. It's no different whether you receive four pieces of evidence that say the same thing or one piece of evidence.
I don't get about this. So if the judge determined that there were substantial differences between the two, he would have turned it over. But if they were substantially the same, he wouldn't? Like, I don't get that decision. It makes no sense.
Perhaps the turnover, if there was a discrepancy on a critical issue that would have affected the parties and their interest in the litigation, then I think the judge makes a discretionary call and tests that information as to whether or not the turnover is required, balancing the rights of the victim, who at the time was a minor, and that of the position of the prosecutor's office, who said, absent a court order, we're not going to turn these materials over because they can contain compromising evidence.
Would the better practice in a case like this have been to turn over the materials in order to allow your adversaries to try to make their best case on the question of duty? You still have your arguments.
Perhaps, but the evidence is not relevant to the inquiry. At some point, the collection of evidence and discovery has to be tempered with the rights of litigants. That's the judicial function. That's why the trial court exists. They make a determination on what is relevant, what should be turned over, and there was a balancing test utilized by the trial court to determine whether or not that information should have been turned over. And if there was a critical issue that could be resolved by the evidence that was requested to be turned over, then yes, that would be the better practice. However, at some point, the judicial function of the trial court must be given some deference. I mean, we've all been in cases where we're burdened with cords of discovery, and most of it, or a lot of it, may not be relevant to a question. That's why we file motions. When we file motions in court, not all of what is requested is turned over, because some of it doesn't matter to the litigation.
If we can get back to the question of the legal discussion about duty. You argued in the beginning that no common law duty should exist here because there is no special relationship between your client, AM, and the person who was abused by KGG, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, there was no relationship.
Right. Now, in just teasing out that theory, in JS, there was no special relationship between the wife and the children. The court was focused on the relationship between the wife and the husband, correct? So you don't have to have a special relationship between the person who is being charged as the defendant and the victim, correct?
Well, Your Honor, I think that becomes a question of foreseeability. In JS, the wife knew who the children were, knew they were coming onto her property.
I'm just probing your answer to the question about no special relationship. It's not rising and falling on the lack of a special relationship. That's my point.
It's not. It's rising and falling on a view of the totality of the circumstances to which you're going to hold somebody responsible.
And does it also take into account whether or not that person had some causal effect in the chain that caused the harm to the individual?
I believe it does, because that's where the test becomes, can that person actually prevent the harm that's
right.
being inflicted upon the victim?
And you say this test that was devised by the appellate division did not take that into account in these facts, correct?
Well, I'm not even sure that there was a test that was fully developed. There was no description about and no explanation about how someone would meet their requirements under a common law duty to report. There's under the statute of Title IX, there's delineations in terms of, okay, you go to DIFAS if you know that there's child abuse occurring.
Mm-hmm.
But here, there's no framework whatsoever to impose the duty. And there's the lack of a special relationship in saying that a coworker has a duty to someone they've never met simply because they, by virtue of their employment.
I know you're coming back to the facts, but I'm trying to engage in a discussion about whether there could potentially ever be a common law duty in the context of coworkers.
In the context of coworkers, I think we're treading down a slippery slope. I think that coworkers doesn't rise to a special relationship that
so is it simply not the fact that they're coworkers, but whether or not the person has received special knowledge that puts them in the position to eliminate causal harm to another?
I think that's correct, and
okay.
Perhaps that's where the inquiry may go. But in this case, there's no relationship. There's a tenuous relationship between the abuser and the defendant. And the problem is that societal concerns and a duty that would be imposed on someone mm-hmm. has to meet the test of fairness.
Mm-hmm. Is it just this, I mean, this fact pattern, does it lend itself to the creation of a duty? Because it's easy to imagine a completely different scenario of facts where you can have two EMTs in a vehicle and one EMT with a minor engaging in inappropriate conduct over a period of time which the other coworker has full knowledge. That might be a different set of circumstances and it might be a more challenging situation for determining whether there's a duty. Would you agree?
I would agree that it would be more challenging. I think that this case is completely distinguishable from that, and I think that would lend to the analysis to whether or not there is a special relationship that has been formed and whether or not there is particularized knowledge that is completely absent here.
By the way, in this case, there was no dispute about the facts that the defendant asserted, correct? As to where he was, what he might have seen. In other words, he set forth, I saw for a brief flash the screen on the flip phone. I never saw anything happen in the vehicle. I was told it was his 22-year-old girlfriend. Two instances when one he went to give lunch money and one to walk somebody to the bus stop where he said it was his daughter. There was no dispute about any of that, was there?
That's correct. There's spin, but there's no dispute.
And there were no facts in the pictures, the cell phone that the judge saw, or the statement of AM that in any way contradicted, at least in the trial judge's mind, what was said by this defendant.
Correct. Correct. There was spin and there was context, but there's no true material.
There were no facts asserted. Like we did something in the vehicle when he was there, or nothing that disputed any of his version of the facts.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the judge had a chance to look at the cell phone and its size, forget everything else, as well as consider the representations made by the defendants.
There was no dispute as to the facts.
Anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Horton. You are welcome to adopt as much of your colleague's argument as you'd like.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice Rabner, Associate Justices, may it please the Court. I represent GEM Ambulance. GEM Ambulance is a medical transport company, employs approximately 400 employees, and operates approximately 100 vehicles. GEM is in the business of essentially scheduling transports of patients to their doctor from nursing homes, assisted living facilities. It also contracts with hospitals in order to pick up patients who are not ambulant and deliver them to their homes. It further responds to emergency calls, will respond to a heliport to bring in victims of emergency calls and transport both the paramedics as well as the patient to the hospitals. GEMS is very concerned about this appellate division decision. It's quite troubling to an employer in several respects. Please understand that GEM is not being sued in this case as the employer of the perpetrator of the crime. Clearly, we should have no liability for a crime that's committed on private time, on private areas, and so forth. We're being sued for failing to properly train and supervise a coworker who is basically being sued for a failure to have proper awareness of circumstantial facts, for a failure to draw and have reasonable cause to believe from those facts that a crime has been committed, a crime of having sex with a minor. The the concern goes beyond how does one train and supervise your employees. Are you supposed to tell your employees that you should not commit a crime? I submit that employer is not responsible for doing that. Are you supposed to train and supervise your employee how to recognize criminal comments or criminal activity and how to draw a reasonable belief from the facts? I submit, Your Honor, that's not appropriate. What if AM had come to his employer, as the appellate division suggests they should have? Is the employer supposed to take an employee's word that I have a reasonable cause to believe so-and-so is involved in criminal activity? What is the employer's obligation, and what is this decision going to expand at that point? The employer now has an obligation to investigate, would it not? You can't take someone's word, an accusation that someone else is committing crime in their personal life, and report that to a policing agency. So now the employer has to undertake a reasonable investigation into private conduct, private remarks of a coworker. It now, presumably, under the appellate division decision, has to draw its own reasonable cause to believe that a crime has been committed, and then report it to the policing agency. Now we have an employer who has ratified what the coworker has said, and that begs the question, is if that is inaccurate information, if that coworker was not guilty of that crime, are we now subject to civil liability for defamation, malicious prosecution? We have no immunity by statute. We are not subject to the obligations, in this case, of Title IX. NJSA 9:6-13 provides an immunity for the reporting obligations under that statute, which appropriately has been determined not to apply here. How then does the appellate division come to the conclusion that GEM could have any responsibility and be subjected to civil liability under any scenario here is perplexing. The JS analysis and the Hopkins analysis that was conducted by the appellate division in this case used as a weighing factor and used as the social interest in the outcome the risk of child abuse against the burden of making a phone call. That's inappropriate. The burden here is not making a phone call. The burden that the appellate division is putting on employers is the burden of investigating circumstances, of causing all of their coworkers to now be attentive to the personal remarks, personal conduct, bragging, or any other thing that takes place in the workplace that's unrelated to the employer's work. Because now, if they do not form a reasonable belief that criminal activity has been committed, they're subjected to civil liability. That's the burden that the appellate division is placing on employers. And the further burden implicit in that is the burden to investigate whether or not that's a legitimate, reasonable belief. You can't, if you're going to create a common law duty, confine it to sexual molestation or child abuse. As reprehensible as that is that any more reprehensible than murder or rape, atrocious assault, mayhem, domestic violence? So this decision opens a panoply of potential theories of liability against employers that cannot be controlled rationally based upon the principles that the appellate division espouses.
Well, it's really based upon the facts of the case, isn't it? I mean, you would still have an obligation as an employer to make sure that there isn't a hostile environment, and if you received information about that with from people under your employ, you'd have to act on that, wouldn't you?
You would. You would, Justice Timpone. You would have to, in that instance, relate what's going on to the workplace. It would have to be done in furtherance of the employer's business and purpose. It would have to be involving the scope of employment of the employees. We've laid out in our papers the fact that there's absolutely no correlation, whether it be the actual criminal act or the actual act of viewing sexual photos on a flip phone. Neither of those have any relationship to the business of GEM Ambulance.
So you agree that if an EMT was driving one of the vehicles while another EMT in the back of the vehicle is molesting a minor, that the employer would have liability under those circumstances?
The employer would have an obligation to act under those circumstances if it had knowledge of what was happening, yes. You could not ignore that. Why? Because that is improper activity that is taking place in the course of the business of GEM. And any employer would have to react to that, correct?
And would you have agency liability as a result of the driver's inaction to report under the little scenario that I gave you, the hypothetical? He's not doing anything. He's just driving the vehicle while all this mayhem is occurring in the back.
The rhetorical answer would be, do you believe that I have to tell an employee that's improper? If I learned of it, I would have to take actions. And by the way, the proper
You wouldn't be responsible for the driver's negligence, not to report or stop it?
I don't believe I would. It's a criminal. Would you call it a conspiracy? Would you, call it some other criminal activity? But an employer is not gratifying or doing anything that would create an opportunity for that.
That is improper conduct, counsel,
by the employee.
Counsel, change the facts just a little bit and make it a little closer to this situation. Suppose AM had come to his employer and said, I'm in a sexually harassing environment because my coworker is making me look at pornographic images on his phone when I have to ride in a shift with him. And it looks like those photos are involving a minor. Employer investigates per normal employment discrimination harassment procedures. And you ask to look at the phone, and you see that the phone does have pictures of sexual images involving a minor. Would you think in that circumstance, GEM would have an obligation to do more than simply resolve the employment hostile environment situation and act outside of the confines of the employment situation?
You know that GEM fired this employee the minute it found out of the matters he was accused of. So KG was terminated immediately. Mm-hmm. GEM, in that instance, would terminate that employee immediately. We have, by the way, and it's in the appendix.
But answer my question, if you would.
That says immoral conduct is not permitted.
If the images showed an individual, let's say it did actually show a face, would you have an obligation to report that to the police? An image of a child being sexually abused.
The simple fact that this person is displaying child pornography on his flip phone.
Mm-hmm. To a coworker who complained.
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
What about take the facts of this case? And yes. In addition to showing the photo, the individual said, that's my girlfriend. She's 15.
We have a different case then.
And what would your obligation be?
I believe in that instance, that's a tough call.
But aren't we going to far from what you're, what the cause of action against you here is? Because these are after-the-fact actions by the employer once you determine that someone's acting improperly. Hmm? The cause of action here is for failure to train,
isn't it?
And what we're asking about now is what you would do if you were aware that something happened. The cause of action against you here, you failed to prevent that from happening by failure to train. So we're far afield, aren't we, from what you're
very
sued
far
for?
Afield at this point, Your Honor. The troubling part of that question, of course, and I realize there's a moral answer, but the legal answer, I believe, is not as palatable as the moral answer.
Well, your client took immediate action as soon as they knew there was an issue with a minor, correct?
Yes, we took
and the and the action was termination
of the employee, correct?
And at that point, there was no issue with respect to reporting because the police already knew about it.
That's correct.
So the action you took potentially would be your action in the instance that the chief is talking about, correct?
That's correct. But you see, the appellate division relies heavily, and this is Chief Justice Ravner's question and focus, which I would suggest should not be answered in this case, but see something, say something. That was the appellate division's adoption of the mantra of terrorism, right? Well, the only problem I have with that is if you see something and you don't say something, you're not subject to civil liability.
Your position, I think, is very simple. If AM has no duty, I can't possibly have had a duty to train him. And it's as simple
as that.
You're writing on whether or not AM has a duty.
That's correct. That is the, certainly the most straightforward. But I go further in my argument, Your Honor, and I say even if he had a duty, that is not related to any business purpose. The idea of formulating a reasonable belief of child abuse.
But if this court were to find that AM, had no duty, for your purposes, that would end the analysis, no?
That should.
Okay. Anything you'd like to add?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Gonzalez.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court. I represent a 14-year-old victim who was repeatedly sexually assaulted by the defendant, KG. He's presently in jail for the conviction of sexual assault to her. The assault occurred while plaintiff was 14, just turning 15 years old. KG abused the confidence gained through the plaintiff's family while coaching soccer, befriended the plaintiff, and was even unwittingly accepted by the family, inviting him to the plaintiff's quinceañera party. KG was seen as an authority figure while he was wearing his GEM uniform. He would wear a GEM badge. He would operate the GEM ambulance. He crossed the bounds of decency when he started the sexual abuse of the plaintiff. His actions were undefendable, and to further the abuse, he started to photograph and videotape the horrific, graphic sexual perversions that he was seeking. KGG would show these same images to his employees, one being AM, his co-employees, one being AM, and other employees at the GEM facility within their factory or their location where they kept the vehicles. That's all in the transcripts, and we do rely on that. KGG would also meet the plaintiff during his employment hours and using the GEM ambulance, which was either manned by AM or another GEM EMT, and this was during the work schedule. KGG, also a co-employee, would drive the GEM ambulance to school bus stop in the morning. He would meet the plaintiff before she got onto the school bus, and then the school bus would take her to the high school. The failure of AM to report the misuse of the ambulance and KGG's behavior of showing explicit sexual photographs and videos to his supervisor prolonged the sexual assault on a minor. AM and other GEM EMTs had a reasonable, objective belief that an act of child abuse had occurred. failure to report that reasonable objective belief allowed the continuous ongoing acts of child abuse. JEM allowed and had a culture of no supervision that allowed the poisonous atmosphere where the EMTs allowed the viewing of graphic sexual images of a minor. We rely on the detailed bullet points outlined in the appellant's brief as to the facts that should have been evaluated by a jury on imposing liability on AM and JEM. Our position is that AM should be equated to the spouse in the JS decision, and he should be found responsible as a spouse in JS. In this case, it is not suspicion of sex. Sex is disclosed, and very odd behavior is talked about by all the EMTs when it came to KGG. EMT is showing sexual videos to his co-employees and then meeting a minor at the bus stop, taken together, gives enough reasonable inference that a jury should have decided that. We need to also rely that EMTs are specially trained. And the reason they're specially trained is because they need to treat individuals. Sometimes I can't say their age because of their condition. So when they receive their training, they're able to look at a body and estimate approximately the age of the individual to ensure the treatment that they provide is adequate. They are first responders also. AM argues that there is no duty. We disagree. A jury could have looked at the totality of facts to establish negligence on AM. Failure to report to JEM's supervisor and EMTs, which allowed further sexual assault on the plaintiff.
Mr. Gonzalez, why don't you highlight for us the critical facts that you believe form a reasonable belief on AM's part that child abuse was taking place?
Absolutely. We had the opportunity to depose AM. And when he was deposed, his testimony was, I may have looked at the videos maybe once, maybe twice. He also testified that when he's at the JEM facility, nobody likes KGG because he is obnoxious, he's braggadocious, and he's showing images of naked women, a naked girl, showing explicit sexual acts on himself and her doing the acts also. Not just to AM, but to the other co-employees.
Is this also what AM said?
Yes.
Did AM refer to her as a girl?
Well,
that's a very important point, because what you're inferring in your description is that he identified this person as having not known that she was a minor. And my understanding of the record is quite the opposite. So are you representing that there was testimony that he stated that he recognized this person as a minor?
He recognized the person as a girl. Didn't say a minor. He does identify the individual by the name that KGG calls her.
When you're using the term girl, are you referring to gender in general, or are you referring to age?
At this point, I'll say gender in general, because I want to get all the facts so I can make the argument as to why I think there was a reason that this could have gone to the jury to establish the age of the individual, just for this purpose, Justice. In this situation, that's one factor that AM should have looked at and said, this guy's strange. Nobody in the facility likes him.
Didn't he use the term... doesn't necessarily make you a child molester, does it?
No, but if somebody...
Being obnoxious doesn't necessarily make you a child molester, because that's what you're arguing, that nobody liked him, he was obnoxious.
Well, that's the first part. That's the first part.
Well, wasn't his term naked females?
Yes.
That was the term he actually used.
Yes.
So that's not girl.
Naked female.
Okay, there's a big difference, isn't there?
Well,
girl would denote a minor.
A girl could denote a minor, yes, it could, Judge. But
did he ever suggest that he was shown photographs of KGG involved with a minor?
Yes.
He said that.
Well, no, he didn't say that in the depositions. He did say that during the investigation with the police department. And we received that police report. And although during depositions he said, well, I was only at the bus stop one time, that's not what he said to the police department. Likewise, we were unable...
Tell us precisely what he said to the police department.
He said that he was working with with KGG at least 7 to 9 times during his period of employment, which we did some...
But wait a minute.
Yes.
If I recall, he said he was working with him 7 or 9 times. He never said anything out. Although 7 or 9 times he went to a bus stop, but it was a girl involved. The only time he mentioned a girl was when he said he had taken lunch to his daughter. Is that what the police report indicates, not basically what you're saying now?
The police report does indicate that, but when we did our discovery process, we also found that he worked with Gomez for at least 100 hours.
But you're talking about what AM said, not what you found during the discovery process. So let's not conflate the two. You're telling us now what AM said.
Yes.
And AM didn't say what you just said he said.
Well, he said that to the police, that he... During the depositions, it was only one time that he stated that he...
Let me try to focus your my question for your answer, if I could. Let's not try to approach this as a jury argument. Tell us what you think are the critical factors that bear on a reasonable belief that there was molestation of a child in this case. You mentioned earlier that the display of images of naked females.
That's correct.
You mentioned meeting a minor at a bus stop. What do you consider to be critical factors? Put aside the weak stuff, obnoxious behavior and the like. You understand what I'm asking?
I do, Judge. And the next critical factor was something that we were never able to obtain. And that was what the actual images were, to establish if that was the individual that AM identified as the person KGG told him it was.
So we know, and I know your arm is tied behind your back to some extent because you haven't seen the photos, but
right.
The Ocean County Prosecutor's Office has told us there was no facial images visible on these.
But that's not the testimony that my client gave. And
go ahead.
That's not the information that he provided to the prosecutor's office. And the prosecutor's office initially was willing to give us this information, and we made application to have an in-camera view of the judge, with the judge, so that we could see what the images were, in fact, and then we would be able to establish if the testimony that AM had been providing was truthful.
So what's the testimony of your client in this regard? That you want to highlight for us?
That she was providing sexual pictures of herself, containing pictures of herself, her face, her body parts, and in sexual acts with KGG and also by herself.
So the problem is, even if those photographs were released, AM has said, I never saw them. So how do you get over that?
He said in the depositions, but that's not what he said to the police who were investigating this.
Okay, so that's why I'm asking to be precise. I don't, with respect to the police report, tell us precisely the language in the police report that you feel support your claim.
The police report essentially says that AM was shown photographs and videos by KGG. The amount of times is not exactly sure how many, but it appears that it's more than just one time, as he said during the depositions.
I'm just asking you what is in the police report, not any inferences or anything. Tell me what was in the police report.
That he worked 7 to 9 times with KGG, and that photographs and videos were shown to him.
And what, if any, description of those photos and videos is there in the police report?
It's not exactly clear, Judge.
Let's assume for a minute, you made the argument that they were negligent because they had all these reasons to believe. Don't you need a duty before we consider negligence?
Well,
and if so, what establishes that duty?
I think JS sets it clear what the duty is. And the critical...
In this case? Because factually they're very different.
It seems that every case that involves this is very different.
That's why we get paid the big bucks.
I understand. I understand. I try to work through this, you know. And essentially, I did see that you could equate AM same as the wife in JS. There was a relationship that
they had. Did AM, is there any evidence that he had any knowledge, any notice that KGG was doing perverse things with children?
With what was the last part?
With children, any children.
Well,
With JS, it wasn't just, it wasn't that she knew that something was happening with the victim.
They were younger girls.
She knew that her husband had these issues and proclivities, plus the other evidence was what the court relied on.
Yes.
In this case, what do you have?
What I have is the working relationship that AM had with KGG for over 100 hours.
Okay, well, we don't know. 7 to 9 times. We have no idea what that translates into hours, correct?
Well, we do. There was 12-hour shifts.
Okay.
So they would start at 4 in the morning, work to 4 in the afternoon, or 6 in the morning to 6
7
at night.
7 to 9 times, 9 12 times,
over.
Times 12 hours, you got over 100 hours.
I do.
Okay, so I don't know if there's any consistency there.
Well, the reason...
Most EMTs know that.
The reason and the importance of the EMT is... When he was being shown this video, and we don't know exactly what the video showed, other than the testimony of my client, but it could have had my client's face. And he was with KGG at the bus stop. And we know, based on my client's testimony, that he would go to the bus stop every day.
Okay, what does that have to do with AM?
What does it have to do with AM?
Yeah, what does AM know?
AM
what do we
knows
know
that this
AM
behavior is not the normal behavior. And the reason we say that is because he even states that in his deposition that nobody thought that his behavior was proper. And I realize that just being obnoxious is not a reason. But when you couple everything together and you see images of sexual acts, and this is at the workplace, you have to say there's something wrong here. And the EMT is especially trained, and Jem actually has a reporting requirement under NJAC where they even have to report if they suspect that there's some type of sexual behavior going on, if there's something where the EMTs are not handling the individuals right.
You're not arguing that the regulation of the statute applies to this victim. They're talking about people that are picked up by the EMT, that are being treated, things are happening in the vehicle. I mean, the statutes and regs have nothing to do with this circumstance. Even the appellate division said that.
Well, I think that the appellate division, when it was speaking about that, was more or less talking about the argument that I was making as to Title IX.
Yes.
I think it's clear that under the administrative code, that Jem is obligated
did
to
you make that argument to the appellate division?
I did not.
This is a nightmarish situation, and I wanted to ask if there were other facts that you wanted to draw our attention to that bear on the question of a duty.
No, Judge.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Vinny, did you want to offer rebuttal?
I think it's very clear from the arguments made in this case that what we have here is simply not enough to create a duty where one previously did not exist. The dangers of an imposition of duty at this juncture are great. They are far-reaching. They affect everybody in society. The creation of duty here would allow, would essentially impose upon every coworker to police the other coworkers with whom they work. How far down the line are we willing to go? Are we going to make society the eyes and ears of law enforcement? And going back to the Jem involvement, you know, let's assume that AM reported, I was being shown these images. What would happen? KG would be fired, and that would be the end of it. How would that help the victim? The societal interest in making clear and delineated responsibilities of citizens is really, really critical. The imposition of a duty has ramifications to all those involved. There is a danger of over-reporting to the extent that all law enforcement agencies are overburdened by these reports of these tenuous, specious, odd behaviors that don't rise to the level of a criminal act or knowledge of a criminal act. There is no immunity to reporters who act in good faith and report something. That is not going to be created if there is a duty created under the common law. There's no immunity. You will find yourself, like AM did here, if you report too late, the subject of a lawsuit and bear the hefty burden of defending yourself in court. That is not what was contemplated, and I don't believe that the appellate division believed that that was contemplated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to all counsel for the very professional arguments. Court will take this under advisement. Court's in recess until 1:00.